28th. Members, we have a lengthy agenda, which I think we can get through. I know a lot of these bills shouldn't elicit a lot of controversy, but we want to make sure we have plenty of time to finish our agenda. We have first on the agenda is Senate File 1934, Senator Dames. Looks like you have a series of bills. Good morning, Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Today I would like to introduce Senate File number 1934. Senate File number 1934 is an act related to insurance regarding Township Mutual Fire Insurance Company combination policies. A little oversight on the bill. Currently, Township Mutuals are allowed to sell homeowners insurance in the state of Minnesota under Section 2010, under the statute 2010, Section 65A, and are allowed to sell farm policies under Statute 2010, Section 67A. There is a difference between the statutes of limitations under 65A and 67A, and so today I have with me Marcus Marsh and also Paul Wilken to testify on behalf of the bill and how it affects their businesses. So I'll open it up with Marcus.
Hey, Mr. Marsh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Marcus Marsh with the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. Our member companies are 93 farm or township mutuals across the state of Minnesota. We're all captive Minnesota, and we have three larger companies that we buy reinsurance and put together our combination policies for different items that we do not cover, different perils we do not cover. I am going to turn it over to our legal counsel, Mr. Paul Wilken from Willenbrink, Dahl and Wilken in Cold Spring. We also have the chairman of our Government Affairs Committee and manager of Woodland Mutual, Richard Ron, that's right here for any questions people might have or understanding the policy issue or a good resource for all of us because he works in the field every day. So I'm going to turn over the legal aspect of it to our legal counsel, Paul Wolkoff.
Okay, let me just announce also the committee that we do have a quorum present. Mr. Wilken.
Thank you, Senator.
Welcome.
I understand you have a full agenda, so I'll try and be brief. By way of background, gentlemen, the bill that's before the committee was prompted by a decision that affects significantly the township mutual industry, which was handed down by our Court of Appeals as of January 13th. Very briefly, the situation that gave rise to that particular case was what I would characterize as a classic farm situation, which is what most of the township mutuals are insuring out in rural Minnesota, farm property in which they write combination package policies. As the committee members know, the township mutual industry is governed by 67A. There's a specific chapter in Minnesota law that deals with township mutuals, and township mutuals under that section of the statutes are exempt and have been exempt for decades from the insurance laws of Minnesota unless a specific statute specifies otherwise. As a result of that, township mutuals have been insuring property with certain provisions which excludes them from things like a two-year policy limitation which applies under 65A to the non-township mutuals in Minnesota, things like valued policy law that the township mutual industry is exempt from, certain types of cancellation requirements which are unique to township mutuals. The township mutuals have operated under those set of standards for, as I said, decades, and have done business in insuring farm property with those provisions under 67A. In 1994, 67A 191, Subdivision 1 and 2 was passed by the legislature, And the essence of that statute was to recognize that there was a distinction between a farm combination package policy and a homeowner's policy. And at that time, Township Mutuals were expressing some interest in having the opportunity to write homeowner's policies. And as the result of negotiations between the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies, the Department of Commerce, and so forth, we had 67A-191, which was passed, and which recognized that when Township Mutuals want to write homeowners' policies, they were required under Subdivision 2 of that statute to abide by the rules of 65A that govern all of the insurers in Minnesota. That statute has been interpreted since its passage without too much difficulty. However, as I said earlier, back in January, the Court of Appeals issued a decision in a case which involved what I would characterize as a classic farm situation, a farm combination package policy in which the insured had a dwelling that was insured along with barns, outbuildings, livestock, farm implements, etc. In that particular case, there was a fire loss to the insured's dwelling. There was a total loss. There was a dispute. It went to appraisal under the policy, and it was resolved, and the loss was paid. At that time, the Township Mutual considered the case closed, and we thought things were done. The policyholder brought suit on the last day of the two-year period, which is the policy period of limitation under 65A, in essence arguing that valued policy law applied and that this was a homeowner's policy. We brought a motion for summary judgment at the district court level. The summary judgment was granted. The case was dismissed. The policyholder took the case up on appeal. Court of Appeals, in a decision, ruled that with every Township Mutual policy, that portion that covers the dwelling was determined to be a homeowner's policy subject to 65A. The effect of that decision, in my personal view at least, is to basically undo the decades of case law and principles by which the Township Mutual industry has operated. And in this particular case, the issue was a one-year versus a two-year policy period of limitation. We were arguing that the one-year under the Township Mutual Subdivision 1 of 67A-191 Subdivision 1 applied because this was clearly a combination farm policy. As I said, the Court of Appeals ruled that every Township Mutual policy, that portion which insures the dwelling, would now, for the first time under Minnesota law, be treated as a homeowner's policy and subject to the provisions of 65A. In my personal view, the decision is far-reaching in the sense that not only does that then impose arguably upon all Township Mutuals a new policy period of limitation from 1 year to 2 year, but it also has the effect of imposing upon the Township Mutual industry all of the provisions that they had done business under, such as valued policy law, cancellation procedures, etc. So now we have a decision, gentlemen, that basically provides that every dwelling portion of a Township Mutual policy is to be governed by 65A. And the bill before this committee attempts to clarify and specify under 67A-191 Subdivision 1 and 2 what was intended, we think was intended, by the original legislation, and to basically affirm the practice that the Township Mutuals have done business by for the last 80, 90 years, which is to follow the mandates of 67A. Under Subdivision 1, the language that has been suggested as an amendment to that simply clarifies that when we're talking about a dwelling, that the dwelling is qualified property. And briefly, the history under 67A-191 is that you'll see that it makes reference to 67A-14 Subdivision 1. That portion of the statute defines what qualified property is, which is what Township Mutuals by law are permitted to write, and basically it is fire coverage and theft coverage only. They then package their policy with a statewide carrier that writes the liability and the wind. Township Mutuals cannot write wind or liability. So 67A 14 subdivision 1 provides that Township Mutuals will be permitted to insure qualified property. And in that particular statute, it defines qualified property as including a dwelling. In this particular case, there was no factual dispute that the house burned down, not the barn. And the court made its decision, however, relying upon 65A27 for its definition of what a homeowner's policy would be. The attempt under the language under Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2 is to simply codify the practice that Township Mutuals have done business by for decades, and that is to specify and clarify that qualified property includes dwellings, and that when a Township Mutual issues a combination package policy which insures a dwelling, that it still maintains the protections that it has under Chapter 67A, and it does not fall then into a homeowner's policy under 65A. I think that pretty much covers it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Walken. Any questions for the witness? Then do you have, Senator Dames, you have another witness, Richard Rahn. Did he need to speak, or is he just here
for
questions?
He's here for a resource.
Okay. Well, then, Senator Dames, let me see if I, because we've met before on this. In fact, this was a topic of discussion when a few of us were out at Redwood Falls meeting with some of your constituents that were dealing with a lot of these insurance issues. This is one of the agenda items. So essentially what we're talking about here is the Township Mutuals have been operating under an operating premise for decades, or as long as anybody can remember. A court of appeals interpreted a statute suddenly different and turned the industry on its head. So this bill's purpose is to put that clarification back, to put things the way they were so everybody understands how these properties are to be treated. Is that what you're trying to accomplish here?
In a nutshell, that's exactly what we're trying to accomplish.
Yep. Okay. All right. So anybody else, does anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against this legislation? Then members, other questions? Senator Reinert has a lot of questions, I bet, right? Okay. All right. Well, then, Senator Dames, do you have anything else to conclude with? Or?
Well, we do at this point. The Commerce Committee does have a few issues that we plan on working out, so I'd like to...
You mean
to,
the Department?
Commerce Department.
Department of Commerce, I'm sorry. The Department of Commerce has some issues that we would like to get worked out. So what I'd like to do is move the bill, be passed, and sent to general orders, and we'll work those issues out before we get to the floor.
Okay. Sir James, can you tell us what the nature of those are? The department didn't testify on the bill. Is it something can you tell us what the nature of the issue is, and is it substantial or is it very minor?
Well, at this point, the department don't feel they've had the time to do the research to make a decision on it, so they would like some time to do the research and see how they feel on the bill. So we would like to give them that opportunity, but yet we'd like to move the bill forward. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, Mr. Chair and members, that is out there and that we do want to honor that opportunity for the department to have their input. So that's one way.
Certainly. Okay. Senators, but there's nothing specific.
There's
on
not
it. No
a
proposals,
specific issue.
No issue or anything like that.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify, we met with Commissioner Rothman last Thursday and folks from the department.
Okay.
And they were aware of the situation and know it's a very serious matter for us, mm-hmm. and encouraged us to move forward. And John Reich is here. We're working with him and the commissioner, and so they're just doing a review process. And normally we always meet with them before we go forward with anything, just to make sure we're all on the same page and there's no surprises. So we'll continue to work with the department.
Okay. All right. Well, then, Senator Dames moves that Senate file 1934. There've been no amendments. Be recommended to pass and sent to general orders. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails, and Senate file 1934 is recommended to pass and sent to general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Am I wrapping up the wrong time? And Senator Dames, your next bill on the agenda I have here is 1793. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate file 1793 is a bill for an act relating to insurance, modifying the definition of a health plan company, and creating new law under Minnesota Statute Chapter 645. Under the new law, the term health plan company or health plan companies, when used in Minnesota statute, does not apply to an entity that offers, sells, issues, or renews only products expressly excluded from the definition of a health plan under Section 62A. Currently, what we're running into now is we have a definition of a health plan and a health plan company. There's a difference in those definitions, and so it's causing some problems with some of the companies that do per diem type policies or fixed indemnity payment type policies. So this language would help clarify that under Statute 62A. It shows some of the exclusions which would not be considered to be a health plan in Minnesota, and one of those exclusions, there are 12 of them. One of them is a policy designed solely for payments on a per diem or fixed indemnity or non-expense incurred basis. This bill would help resolve the confusion in the current statutes caused by imprecise use of the term health plan. And also, we would clarify that the products excluded from the definition of a health plan are also excluded from the definition of a health plan company. And with me today to testify, I have Bob Tennyson, and Bob was with Aflac, and Bob can explain how this does affect their company and, in a sense, would affect other companies that sell similar products.
Mr. Tennyson, welcome
to the committee. Thank you. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis with Tennyson Law, and I represent Aflac and have for 20 years. This is a fairly simple bill. It resolves a definitional problem that has existed for several years. The problem is because of the circuitous nature in which the definition of health plan company is reached. I've provided all of you with a memorandum, I think, laying out the steps you have to go through, and I won't go through those here in interest of time. But the circuitous route results in an application of the law to products. The use of the term health plan company is applied in 130-some statutes, and it results in some confusing, absurd results when applied to these kind of products that Senator Dames talked about. It doesn't work. And while the bill is not a huge bill, it's not retroactive. It does address future definitions or future use of the term health plan company. So that in the future, when the term health plan company is defined or used in the statute, this definition will specifically exclude four items that are currently listed in the health definition of a health plan. It doesn't mean the legislature can include them, but it means it would do so consciously rather than by default. It means that if you want to include the products in the definition of a health plan, then specifically state so. It doesn't change what's already there, but it does prospectively, and really that's what it does. It's prospective. It means that when the legislature uses the term health plan company in the future, they have to specifically decide whether or not these products that are excluded from the definition of a health plan, the ones that we pick up here, are also included or intended to be covered in their future legislation. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Senator, any questions from the committee members?
As clear as mud.
Anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against? Okay, then Senator Dames, let me if I just attempt to make sure that I understand this. So essentially, the definitions we use in statute for health care or health plan company are sufficiently broad that they capture a company like Aflac in its net when it doesn't apply. And so
correct.
This bill solves that purpose by separating those out so you have your health plan company definition, and then you're not caught up in all of the extra statutes and rules and such that don't even apply to your business. Is that a good summary of what you're trying to get at?
Yes, and part of the problem is that it would be pretty hard for a per diem company to qualify for some of the rules and regulations that they would have to qualify under the health plan carrier because they're excluded under the health plan language. So we want to get that language so it's similar so that everybody knows where they are in that process.
All right. So then,
Mr. Chairman, I might clarify one thing.
Benson.
It's the products that are excluded, not the companies.
Not the company.
If the company were to sell some other products that are covered under health plan, they're still covered. It's just and nationally, there's some like 17 companies that sell these kind of products. I don't know how many of them are admitted in Minnesota, but that's a number.
Okay.
And if somebody wants to read all 130 statutes, I have an analysis. I'm happy to provide you.
Okay. All right, then. Senator Dames, we see no further discussion. Then Senator Dames moves that Senate File 1793 be recommended to pass and sent to general orders. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. And the motion prevails, and Senate File 1793 is recommended to pass and sent to general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dames.
Thank you. And next on the agenda, Senator Dames, a third bill. It's the Dames Day. Every dog has his day, right?
Oh. Okay.
Your correct response is woof.
Oh.
You get three bills here.
Oh my God. Okay.
We're doing insurance. We got to kind of, liven it up a little bit here.
Senator Mr. Dames. Chair and members.
Senator Dames.
Senate file.
Oh, very good.
Mr. Chair, I think you're about as red as I am, so we'll move on now. Senate file number 1875 is a bill relating to insurance, property, and casualty permitting written disclosure of guarantee association coverage when a policy is delivered, expanding access to accident reports to include all parties involved. In a nutshell, what this bill does is it would allow insurance companies to issue the notice of the Minnesota Guarantee Fund instead of doing it at the time the policy is written. That's pretty hard to do over the telephone, and it takes a lot of time. So what this bill would allow is allow the insurance company to choose an alternate method, and that would be to send out the notification with the policy. The other portion of the bill deals with getting the accident reports, and this bill would allow people that are involved in the accident, the insurer, legal counsel, or the insured, to request the accident report. Currently, under Minnesota statute, in order for an insurance company to get a copy of the accident report, they need written approval. Well, in the contract language, it's already stated in the contract that if you're in an accident, you have to cooperate with your insurance company and allow the insurance company to get the proper paperwork and things that they need. So by allowing the insurance company to go ahead and get the accident report without the written approval of the insured, it moves the process much faster and allows for the insurance companies to settle the claims on a quicker basis. So with that said, I do have some testifiers with me today. We have Doug Franzen and Dan
Rested.
And so we'll go ahead, and I'll turn it over to Doug.
Mr. Franzen, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm representing the Property Casualty Insurers of America, National Trade Association of Property Casualty Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'd like to clarify that our author's barking does not indicate his opinion that this bill's a real dog. Mr. Chairman, as mentioned, this bill, well, there are three. If I am in an auto accident or if I suffer a loss in my homeowner's insurance, there's really three things I want as a consumer. One is obviously to be treated fairly, and we believe we do our best to accomplish that goal. Secondly is to get my claim settled as quickly as possible. And the third thing I want is as little hassle for me as possible. And I think what I want when I'm involved in an incident sums up what everybody wants. We think we're doing pretty good on the fairness right now, and this bill addresses the other two. By promoting a quicker access to accident reports, which, as the senator said, the insurance company will get under contract with its consumer, with its insured right now, we're able to settle the claim quicker. Under the current procedure, the individual insured who has suffered this trauma has to go make the request, send it to the company. We attach it to a form. It goes to the Department of Public Service or Public Safety, excuse me. And we believe that additional step is really unnecessary, and it really does nothing to protect the consumer. And, in fact, this arose when Mr. Resta came here from North Dakota and said, why in the world do you people do that? No other state does. It just slows down the insurance customer getting their money. And I do have, if the chair is interested, the forms of the other state. And, again, it's much simpler. We've talked to the Department of Vehicle Services. It is clearly their intent through the regulatory execution of their administrative responsibilities to ensure that this information doesn't go to wayward third parties, that it stays with either the insurance company who covers the loss or with the attorney for the insured. And we've heard no opposition from them. We have been in recent conversation with the Department of Commerce. They have some technical concerns with the part I will talk about in the next segment. It is our mutual desire, both the industry and commerce, that we sit down and we can easily resolve these technical concerns before coming to the floor. Again, the second part deals with the second part of the bill, which is actually Section 1, deals with the delivery of the guarantee fund notice. The guarantee fund notice simply is a state-mandated notice we give to consumers that says there is such a thing as a guarantee fund. Its purpose is to make you whole in the event of an insolvency. Mr. Chairman, it uses an awful lot of words to say that. And it's really no problem if you're giving a written notice. But if a customer calls and desires to purchase insurance over the telephone, we know it's a problem because it's long, it's tedious. It certainly wouldn't keep my attention, or I, you know, Lord help me if there's a quiz on it immediately after I hear it, because I will not retain it. And we also, as what we believe are good insurance companies, we believe there may be an issue of compliance out there with people. It may be easier for an agent in some cases to say, well, I'm not going to bother with that and just pretend I did. And that's not a good situation for anybody. This accommodates new technology. It's easy to buy insurance right now. Elaine Love over here with us from Farmers could buy an insurance policy on her iPhone before I finish talking. She did it on the telephone. She'd have to listen to the notice. So this, again, speeds it up for the consumer. There's no issue that they will get the notice. We believe it will be a superior notice because it will be in a manner in which they can actually sit down and read it and have full comprehension and have that assurance that the state of Minnesota does give to each and every insurance consumer that there is protection there. And as a final point, I would say, Mr. Chair, is that what we've attempted to do in the guarantee fund notice is to conform the notice to what this legislature has done in the life health area. We believe that the telephone sales in life health is already, you've dealt with that already, and I believe it was last year, Mr. Chairman. This conforms property casualty. It's a pretty simple bill. It's a pretty straightforward bill, Mr. Chairman. We ask for your support.
Okay. Senator Gazelka. Good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's more of a comment. The guaranteed association form in the first place, if we're going to give it out at all, that's about the right time to do it. That'd frankly be okay with me if that just went away in particular. But, you know, it's just another process that we don't have to add into the system. But And then the other part about granting access to traffic accident reports, it, you know, being an insurance agent and handling many, many claims over the years, this absolutely will speed up the time. There are some people that just don't get around to getting that form in, and then the insurance companies cannot work on the claim. They cannot pay their people. And so I really – it's a great idea, and I'm glad you guys are bringing it forth. Senator Dames, thank you for doing this.
Senator Dames, you have other testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I was remiss. I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. So if we could pass that out.
Okay.
And while that is being passed out, what the A1 amendment does is it changes Minnesota Statute 2010, Section 65B, 4.82, to allow the insurance companies to provide the insurance identification cards electronically or in electronic format if the insured agrees and would like to receive them that way. So it's just a little paragraph change, but what it does is it allows the insurance companies to use electronic format to issue insurance identification or proof of insurance cards if the insured so agrees.
Senator Dames, let's go ahead and adopt it first. Because this is an author's amendment. So, members, Senator Dame moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. And the motion prevails, so the amendment is adopted. Senator Dames, this is a similar or same amendment that we added to a bill of yours last week. Is that correct? Didn't we put this on your...
Yes, this was on the, bill for the... electronic tracking of insurance, if you have insurance
right.
or not. We did
same.
Also amend the bill there to add it there. Add it
okay.
there.
And then, Senator Dames, I know that my insurance company will send me an email with insurance cards on it, and I think they send them to me in the mail as well, but I can print them off. You're saying that I could just get them. I mean, I don't know if I'm wondering if I – well, they send them to me in the mail anyway. So
that is required.
Covered. That is required.
It is required, yes.
And
yep.
But this is, if I said don't bother, just send them to me electronically, I can then.
Then you would be able to receive them electronically.
So either way.
It would be your responsibility then to print it and put it in your
okay.
vehicle.
Because they do it both ways to me that I know now.
Correct.
Okay, okay then. Did you wanted to have other testifiers, or did members have any questions of?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. Senator Dames, if a police officer or somebody wanted verification of the insurance, could they just show them their electronic version, or does it still have to be printed? Or
and at this point, we haven't dealt with that in this statute. It just states that they could provide it in electronic format.
Okay. Great idea.
Okay. All right. Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to that as well.
Sure.
as an attorney. And as someone who has been stopped by police for speeding. And I didn't happen to, and the insurance card I had was expired by 3 days.
Right.
And I got a $150 ticket, which would be forgiven upon proof of insurance. As a legal matter, I believe if the format were proper, the electronic version, would suffice for law enforcement. Because right now, when you think about it, what they do is they don't take a picture of your card. They just look at it and verify it and give it back to you. And I do know that law enforcement really doesn't like to write $150 tickets for people they think have insurance but have an expired card. So my legal opinion, Mr. Chairman, would be, yes, that showing your iPhone would suffice. If I can get on an airplane from Delta with my iPhone, I can probably get out of a speeding ticket.
All right. Thanks, Speedy. Okay. let's see. I think Mr. Rested, Dan Rested, did you want to testify?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I would only reiterate what's been said already with respect to speed and service.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Then, is there any other questions from the members? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against Senator Dames' bill? Then, seeing none now, Senator Dames, the Judiciary Committee has requested this bill. I don't know if you're aware of that or not.
Yes.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, we do have some The department does have some concerns on part of the bill, so we will be working with the department on those concerns prior to getting to judiciary to get those ironed out. But I just wanted to let the committee and the members know that there is some concern, and we will be working with the department on those issues.
Okay. Again, I would just say that if there are specific concerns, I'd like to deal with them in the Commerce Committee. So I guess I would just advise you to that I mean, we can pass it. I don't want to delay it, but if there was something specific, we would deal with it. But if it's non-specific, it's really impossible for us to do that. Did the department want to testify on this? Did you want to, or? I don't know, you're walking up, so I guess we're good.
Yeah, I think that you need to express your concerns.
Sure. Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, John Wright, Department of Commerce. I'm here at the request of Senator Dames. Okay. I hadn't planned on saying anything. Section 1 of the bill deals with the delivery of the MEGA notice with the policy that when the consumer gets the policy, the MEGA notice is in there. Our concern is that if you buy an insurance policy, it's given to you in person. It's given to you at the time of application. If you do it electronically, you get it at the time of application. And so we're trying to figure out a way to, working with Senator Dames and the stakeholders, to ensure that a consumer gets the MEGA notice at least within the general time frame that the other consumers are getting it as well. So they're treated differently as a result of ordering it over the telephone. Obviously, as Mr. Franzen said, reading the MEGA notice, which I've now read, and it is long, and so a phone disclosure, I think, is probably not a practical idea. However, we're trying to figure out a sweet spot so that the consumer who orders something over the telephone isn't treated differently, or much differently at least, than somebody who orders it in person and gets the MEGA notice at the time of application. We've had a number of discussions on the topic over the last couple of days. We've traded language. It's been a matter of coming down to the hearing this morning and not being able to vet it, as I understand it, through the companies in time for the hearing. So, Mr. Chair, that's the extent of our concerns, and as stated by Mr. Franzen, we're happy to continue to work with the stakeholders and Senator Dames moving forward. That pretty much sums it up.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Then Senator Dames moves that Senate File 1875 as recommended. I'm sorry, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and Senate File 1875, as amended, is recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And now I've got a bill.
Next on the agenda, members, is Senate File 1910, Senator Gerlach's bill. Senator Gerlach, again, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're doing kind of an insurance day here, it looks like, at this point. I'm going to, I don't know how I'm going to surpass Mr. Excitement on the last bills here. Where'd he go?
Do you meow like a cat?
Yes. Oh. I'm going to try. I have a bill, member, Senate File 1910. It deals with the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, or MCHA, and this is a technical bill, kind of an annual technical bill. I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, which is just to strike out three lines, but I believe he'll hand out, and while he's handing out, I can explain it. Members, on the page 6 of the bill, towards the bottom, line 6.30 to 3.2, that is a section. It deals with the essential health benefits section of qualified health plans with some federal legislation, and the essential health benefits is a topic that is being hashed over quite extensively in the health committee and such, and I do not want this technical bill to be bogged down in something that may not be technical and such. So the amendment, the author's amendment, the A1, just simply strikes that section out.
Yep.
So we would be that paragraph F. Those three lines, that's what the amendment does. So
Senator Gerlach moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, then, members, as I said, this is the MCHA technical bill, and I've got someone here who's going to explain to you the wonderful details of this bill.
Yes, good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ryan Burt. I'm the MCHA General Counsel, and I'm happy to be here this morning. Very, very quickly, in a nutshell, this bill does three very basic things. First of all, it modifies the mechanism or process that MCHA utilizes to set its premiums. It's very important that the committee understand that this does not change the actual range in which the premiums are set, as that is mandated by law. This does not impact the actual amount that the premiums will do or where they'll be set. And it also does nothing to change the Commerce Department's ultimate authority to accept, reject, or modify MCHA's premiums. This really is all about the process that's utilized to ensure that it's accurate and to try and introduce a little bit of some streamlined administrative process to hopefully save some money. The second thing that it does is it changes the effective date of MCHA's premiums from July 1st of the year to January 1st of the year. And again, that's an attempt to bring MCHA's premiums more in line with what's going on actually in the private market. The third and final thing that the bill does is it permits, it does not mandate, but it permits MCHA to stop offering its lowest deductible health plans, the $500 deductible and the $1,000 deductible, as of 2013. And again, that is not mandatory. So that's a very brief nutshell summary. I'm happy to entertain any questions from the committee.
Senator Brown.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have questions about lines 2.9 through 2.25, and I know you're not changing this language, and it might be something technical, but it does specifically mention Medicare supplement plans, and it's kind of vague as to whether that also refers to Medicare cost plans and Medicare Advantage plans. Would that language cover just specifically Medicare supplement plans, or does it also include cost and advantage plans?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Brown, that's actually a very good question. I think I can answer it by stating this, that one of the ways that MCHA is trying to streamline its process is in setting the rates for the Medicare supplement policies. At this time, they're required to survey the entire market, all of the plans, in order to come up with a weighted average of what the market premiums are. What this would do would streamline it down to just the three largest providers of Medicare supplement plans. So I'm not sure if that gets to it, but that's what it does. It streamlines things down and really focuses on just the majority of the market share and will more than likely lead to the same result, but a much more streamlined process.
Yeah, well, and that's, Mr. Chair, why I asked the question. I think in Minnesota, maybe a majority of the plans are cost and advantage plans, or at least that's the direction things are going. So if you looked at CMS's definition, there would be a distinct difference between supplement plans, cost plans, and advantage plans. So I think maybe it's just something, a technical change we would want to look at, but there is a distinct difference if you look at the definition from CMS on those. So.
Okay.
Mr. Burt, what percentage of the market do the top three have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. I don't have that answer for you today, but it's my understanding that it's the vast majority of the marketplace. And again, it wouldn't materially impact the outcome of what the rates are. Again, it would just streamline the process. But that's something, again, the MCHA executive director is out of town, but that's something that I'm sure that MCHA and along with the Department of Commerce could pull that number for you and be able to provide with you very quickly.
Are there further questions? Is there anybody in the audience testifying for or against? Well, then, Senator Gerlach, any closing comments?
I don't have any, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Senator Gerlach then moves Senate File 1910 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to general order. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate File 1910 as amended is referred general orders.
Senator Thompson. Okay. Still in hand, Senator Thompson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about Senate File 1888, and I'm able to move the author's amendment, so I believe I will do that because it will be helpful if the members have that in front of them as we go over the bill. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A1 amendment, author's amendment, to Senate File 1888.
Okay, if you could hold on one moment, we're just handing it out.
All right, what I'll do is I'll start the discussion of the bill as the members are looking at it, and we can move that again once members have had a chance to look at it. First off, let's talk a little bit about the purpose of this bill and what we're trying to address here. Collection agencies, obviously, in the state of Minnesota, as well as in, I'm sure, all the other 49 states across the country, are regulated, and there are procedures in place to make certain that it is reputable people engaged in the enterprise and reputable people running collection agencies and working as individual collection agents. And so what has been going on, unfortunately, over the recent times in the department is that there have been investigations on issues such as background checks, qualifications for collection agents, those sorts of things, and there seems to be kind of arbitrary standards that are being applied, and so the individual collection agents and individual collection agencies are unaware of the requirements that they are supposed to meet, and therefore the enforcement becomes rather arbitrary, can be extremely costly, and can frankly cost them business. And, in fact, I have spoken with some folks who have registered some concerns, but obviously it's very difficult to come and testify when it involves an agency that directly regulates your business. So the purpose of this bill, Mr. Chair and members, is to attempt to standardize the procedure for qualifying collection agents and collection agencies so that individuals and the businesses that are regulated by the Department of Commerce in this area understand what they are supposed to do and can comply and more or less take the ambiguity out of this. So we're seeking to try to get some predictability here. If it pleases the chair, I think at this point members have had a chance to look at the A1 amendment, and I would reassert my motion to adopt that.
Senator Thompson moves adoption of the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. And the motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. So let's talk just a little bit about what this does. First, as we look at Section 1, that has been eliminated by the amendment, so we need not speak about that because it is no longer a part of the bill. So let's go right on to Section 2. And what we have there is an attempt to eliminate some paperwork requirements that individual debt collectors might have so that if they have a change in name, address, that sort of thing, rather than having to notify the department within 15 days, they're able to notify the department upon their annual renewal to the department. On to Section 3. This really is a large part of the
Senator,
heart of...
Sorry, Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson, on that note, have you looked at how that aligns with other work we have the department do? I mean, it feels it's been a while, and Chair, you would know, it's been a while since I renewed my real estate license, but that's how that aspect goes. If you have a change of address or something, you do it at your annual renewal, isn't it?
I never changed my license or my name during the period that I had the license. So.
You kept your maiden name, Chair?
Even when I got married, yeah, I kept my maiden name. So.
Very liberated of you.
Yes. try to be. Senator Thompson.
Senator, if you don't know offhand, I'm, you know, I know Commerce is here, so they can.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Reinert, honestly, I don't know. My I would be purely speculating as to what the requirement is. I think the concern here is, frankly, a lot of people wouldn't even realize that the requirement exists. And from my perspective, the only reason to require an individual to make such notification within 15 days is if there's some concern about fraud or some untoward behavior going moving forward. And my guess is that if somebody were engaged in fraudulent or criminal activity, they wouldn't be predisposed to fulfill the 15-day notice requirement. So my guess is that this really isn't going to help to get any of the bad guys. It is simply going to burden some folks unnecessarily and, frankly, put some unwitting people, you know, in noncompliance when they don't even intend to. Would be my
Mr. Chair, I'll ask that question of Mr. Reich when he has a chance to testify. In asking the question, my thinking is just to have the Commerce sort of keep a standard set of rules for everybody it interacts with. So,
okay.
All right. Senator Thompson.
Thank you. On to the next section, which would be Section 3. And you'll see that there's a fair amount of language underlined here that kind of details what a collection agency must do in order to screen an individual collector. And interestingly enough, you might think that businesses or individuals that are being regulated wouldn't prefer to have something this specific laid out. But in this particular instance, what I've been told by folks that have talked to me is they actually want it to be very clear as to what they must do to meet the standard of background checks, because one of the problems that they have right now is the department has been unwilling to issue in writing a set of criteria that you can comply with in order to meet the requirement. And so collection agencies may move forward in good faith and more or less have their judgment second-guessed, and some of the fines and penalties can become fairly substantial. So they would actually prefer a very detailed set of criteria so that they are able to make certain that they're in compliance. These things are not, they're not arguing they're overly burdensome. They're just saying we need to know what they are. So that is what is accomplished by Section 3.
If I could interrupt, Senator Thompson, I have a question. The new language in the bill here, you talk about the screening process for initial registration of an individual collector shall consist of a criminal history, record check, statewide county search, et cetera. Are you saying that right now there is no clarification from the department that a screening process needs to check for a criminal history, and that's why you're putting it in the bill, because you want that specificity?
Mr. Chairman, great question. My understanding in speaking with folks in the collections business is that is a requirement de facto, but that it's not clearly laid out. In other words, a collection agency would almost certainly not meet the test required by the Department of Commerce to do a sufficient background check if they didn't do that, but it's not laid out clearly. So they simply want that to be specified.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. On to Section 4. This is a provision that deals with the kind of offenses that if you have engaged in them, you should not be allowed to have a license to do this. And you'll notice in the amendment we did in response to a concern from the Department of Commerce, we did, if you look at line 2.20 there, what the amendment does is it reinstates the word in, crosses out of, and then reinstates court of fraud or any felony. So we tried to put something back in there that the Department of Commerce wanted. And actually, when you look through this, members, one can argue that this more or less strengthened the law pertaining to disqualification from being a collection agent, because if you go down to number 3 there, it talks about number 2, it talks about misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor involving a financial crime, and then in 3 it lists some other things. And in the legal world, we tend to refer to crimes involving embezzlement, fraud with money, those sorts of things, as crimes of moral turpitude. Whether or not they're large enough to fall into the category of a felony, we don't want people to be in a position of dealing with sensitive financial issues if they have a history of that sort of thing. So I believe, and I don't mean to speak for the department, but based upon my conversations with them yesterday. My guess is they're going to object to this, and yet I would argue that in some ways this is actually Section 4 is being strengthened in favor of protecting the consumer from individuals that may have a background that makes them unfit to be an agent.
Yes, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson, can you tell me why you've chosen to strike the language on 2.21 through 2.25 and insert instead, it looks like, seemingly similar language on 2.28 through 2.32. What was wrong with the language that was on the above, and why did you instead put similar language?
Well, the best way I think that I can answer that, Senator Bonoff, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, is that the feeling was that by changing that a little bit and adding numbers 2, 3, and 4, that actually it got more directly to the kinds of activity that should disqualify someone from being in the business. So I think I can't say why specific words were taken out, but I think the general concept was let's try to look at the kinds of offenses that demonstrate a character that should disqualify one from being engaged in this profession. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, no. Okay. It doesn't, because it doesn't sound like you really know why one was stricken and the other was added, because they seem so similar. And it seems to me to change existing statute to, in essence, rewrite a similar thing.
Well, actually, if you look at number one there, Senator Bonoff, Mr. Chair, if you look at that, you'll notice there's a reference to a felony. It says, been convicted now with the amendment in any court of fraud or any felony, mm-hmm. or have been convicted, on it goes. So part of the reason that we got rid of that and inserted number two is we actually want to get at misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors involving financial crimes. Again, if you have shown a propensity to act improperly in financial matters, you probably shouldn't be a debt collector. So and perhaps our witness who will come could state more specifically why that is. But from my perspective as a lawyer, we're actually getting at a group of people that have shown a direct set of actions that are the kinds of things you wouldn't want a debt collector to have done. The felony shouldn't be the standard. The kind of activity should be the standard.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, now I accept that because now I can understand that you'd want your qualifying statement to be after the misdemeanor so that it fell under that. So that now makes sense to me. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, on to the final section here, Section 5. What we have added there is the opportunity for somebody that is subject to an investigation and is found to be in violation, an opportunity for 30 days to cure the problem. Now, you will notice that there were some fairly significant changes made by the author's amendment, and let me just try to describe kind of in principle the reason for those. In talking with some of the folks, that some of the stakeholders in this bill, I pointed out that clearly we would not want to give anybody time to correct a problem if, in fact, they had engaged in improper or fraudulent or criminal kinds of activities. And frankly, I was afraid that this was a little too broad. So what the amendment has done is it has taken out this list of statutory provisions that are in line 3.15 and instead substituted sections of the statute that just deal with mistake or inadvertence or possibly not meeting a technical requirement to make certain that we're not being too hard on businesses that have tried to comply and simply made a mistake, but making sure that we're not giving anybody time to continue in some sort of intentional wrongdoing. So that is the reason there. So in summary, Mr. Chair and members, this is an attempt to provide certainty so that debt collectors, individuals, as well as debt collection agencies know what they must do to comply, to meet the standards, and hopefully take some ambiguity out. I received a fiscal note, kind of to my shock, to see that there is allegedly a cost associated with this. I believe the members, you all have it in your packet. I really kind of question why it would cost an agency more to enforce something that is even clearer. But, of course, I will defer to the folks who create these fiscal notes and therefore ask that after this takes a trip down the yellow brick road through judiciary that we find out if Senator Roebling, the chair of the Finance Committee, would like to see it. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have one person that would like to testify, and then obviously if any others want to come forth, that'd be fine, and I'll be happy to take questions after that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates, representing the Minnesota Association of Collectors, better known as MAC. They are the trade association of third-party debt collectors in the state. We are here today to support Senate File 1888. As Senator Thompson said, what we are seeking is clarity to the statutorily required background checks so that we can ensure that we are not hiring individuals who are who by statute are not permitted to be collectors. Included in your packets is some information about the collection industry in Minnesota, which I hope we will look at. They make a lot of contributions to this economy. And I want to stress it is a very highly regulated industry, both here in the state and federally, and the members of MAC work very hard to comply with all the laws and all the regulations. Please bear with me. I just want to provide a little bit of background regarding Senate File 1888. First of all, Minnesota is one of 38 states that even license collection agencies. We are one of only four states requiring individual licensure or registration of the individual collector, and our statute is far more extensive and requirements far more extensive than other states. Prior to 2004, the department had the responsibility for the background screening, and what our agencies found was that there was quite a backlog at the department, and so we worked with them to develop, to pass a law that basically said we would change it to a registration, and the collection agencies would take on the responsibility for doing the background screening. What was put in statute at that time, the law stated that collection agencies must establish procedures to follow when screening an individual collector applicant prior to submitting an applicant to the commissioner for registration. So it was very not specific about what the screening, background screening procedure should look like. Following passage of the law, we went to the department and asked them for some guidance, and were told they would not give us any guidance on background screening. Individual collection agencies have gone to the department since then and asked them for guidance or asked them to look at their screening procedure to see if it was acceptable, and were also told that they would not provide any guidance. So the department had not indicated any concerns to MAC or its members about the background screening process. And then in December 2010, an article came out in the Star Tribune alleging that there were instances where prohibited individuals were being employed as collectors. We later learned from the agencies involved that most of the people listed in the article had either been fired by the agency, they were offenses that did not disqualify them by statute for being a collector, or they committed the crimes after they'd been hired and the background screening process had been done. And after that, the Department of Commerce came after the agencies listed in the article indicating their background screening processes were inadequate and requiring that and went in to review it. And I think it's important that all of the agencies did have a background screening process in place. The department conducted audits, negotiated consent orders with the collection agencies, resulting in significant fines. And I just want to say that the agencies felt like they needed to sign these consent decrees because they just wanted to move on. This is a big deal to them, just so you know. They were required to alert every state that they operate in about the consent order, and it has created some significant impact for the agencies in terms of business and in terms of relationships with other states. So I just don't want to minimize the impact of what has happened. And so, as you can see, the other agencies want some guidance, and we've been told by the department that we've tried to work with them. They aren't giving us any guidance on what the screening process should look like. So that is the point of the legislation. We just want to know what are the rules of the game, and the MAC members want to do their very best to follow them, and we'll work hard to do that. Right now, their only option is to guess, and if they guess wrong, they face administrative penalties, fines, and significant implications for their business. So we've tried to talk with the department about this and want to continue our conversations, throughout as this bill moves forward. I'm not going to go through the details of the bill. Senator Thompson did a very good job of doing that. I think I do want to talk quickly about the safe harbor provision. We think that's important. And again, Senator Thompson's amendment clarifies that it is only for these administrative type of issues. It's not for anything that would be fraud or abuse or anything else. And then also, Senator Bonhoff, just to add a little bit more information to the question you had, one of the issues that the agencies have with civil judgments is that you don't have as much information available to you as you would in a criminal instance. And so this basically says they go back to the individual and say, give me the information. Because right now, for example, if you have a common name, it's really hard to find out elsewhere. And so it's important that that individual has to give you the information. And so I just want to be clear, we are not trying to weaken the law or evade responsibility. The collection agencies know the value of the screening process. We think this provides important clarity. As I said, they can know the rules of the game. We also feel like we are strengthening the law by adding the gross misdemeanor and the misdemeanor for financial crimes so that we can be sure we're protecting consumers. We do want to work with the department and all of you as this bill moves forward, but we do think it's very important both for the collection agencies and also for the consumers. So I guess I'll be happy to answer any questions with that.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Then seeing none, is that your presentation, Senator Thompson? Anything else?
I have no other witnesses, Mr. Chair, and so you can open it up. I'm done.
Okay. I think first we're going to have Mr. Reich from the department.
Mr. Chair and members, excuse me, I've got pretty much what everybody else has. From the Department of Commerce, thanks for the opportunity to testify. We, at this juncture, are opposed to the bill as drafted. We have been able to take a look at it. We have a series of internal meetings at the department over the last month or so. I've been in constant communication with Ms. Cook, Ms. Strong, Belial, and the stakeholders to see about defining the rules of the road. I think, in principle, that is a noble task and one that we're taking seriously, one that we want to look at, and something that we're willing to talk to the stakeholders about in the coming weeks. And we plan on doing that. I think we spoke this morning of even setting something up at the department to see if there wasn't something that we couldn't figure out. I just, real quickly, Mr. Chair, would like to take issue with one thing that was said, and it's not because you're a North Dakota hockey fan, Senator Thompson. first guy. In any event, I wouldn't characterize the enforcement actions taken by the department earlier this year or last year as arbitrary. There was some serious criminal activity taking place in some instances, and I think there was a strong public interest for some of the enforcement actions that we took. And I just want to say that on the record, and I appreciate what the author's intent is with the bill. I think that part of our mission, I know, as the commissioner has stated, is that we want a fair regulation, but we also want to make sure the business community succeeds in this state. To the extent that we can help foster that, I think we would like to. Lastly, Mr. Chair, we've committed to the stakeholders that we will continue to work on it and plan on doing so. And I would stand for any questions.
I have a question first. I know that there was a couple of things. First of all, I know that the investigations preceded the current commissioner. I mean, these started when Commissioner Wilson was the commissioner, and so this stretches over two administrations. And I know that. You're right, Mr. Reich, when you talk about that, there was some serious criminal activity. One thing I think that Senator Thompson is getting at, and then this will, and I like your reaction, and that is that he is trying to separate. Every industry always has bad actors and people who are just trying to run their business. They want to follow the rules. They want to know what the rules are. Generally, the people who come to the Capitol seeking legislation or seeking or engaged in the political process like this are generally not the bad actors. So I think that Senator Thompson's bill doesn't get at, I mean, he's not doing anything dealing with those legitimate criminal activity efforts that the department went after in some of these collection agencies and brought those to light. I think in many cases, obviously, were properly administered and such. But he's here expressing a lot of frustration. And actually, I mean, you could also with Ms. Cook and her clients of that, they feel that the department has not worked with them in clarifying these. Again, these are what I guess I would classify as people who are just trying to do their business. They want to know what the rules are, yet they have been frustrated. I've been out to visit some of them. They've invited me out. They've been to my office to talk with me, and they are very, very frustrated that they can't get what the rules are so that they can comply with those. And it seems like the department wants to keep it wide open and loosey-goosey or willy-nilly, whatever phrase you want to use, because then there's just with that uncertainty, then it kind of trips people up. And I know the department is not in the business of trying to trip people up, but yet from their perspective, it seems like it. So there's just an enormous amount of frustration with that. My first question is, why are they saying that the department has been unwilling to help them with the screening process requirements and tell them what the rules are through numerous attempts to do that? I know, but then you're testifying that there's a working group in there and working on this. What's with the disconnect between the department and the industry?
Mr. Chair, members, we encounter this with any number of industries as to whether or not we can issue a clarifying bulletin or some sort of clarifying language outside the scope of the law that would give people comfort. I can't answer your question directly, but what my understanding is from talking through this issue with respect to other industries is that the era of some bulletins issuing guidance went away a number of years ago at the department as a result, I think, and now I'm not entirely certain, but as a result, I think, of some legal challenges as the result of those bulletins. So I think that's why we don't issue guidance outside of the scope of the law as to what we would find acceptable, at least official language. I appreciate, however, your comments, Mr. Chair, and that's why I think we've committed to working on this bill going forward, and in fact, last week had a meeting of the minds, so to speak, at the department to try to come up with some issues with the bill, which I relayed to Senator Thompson yesterday, so that we could start the conversation.
Okay, well, then, Mr. Reich, that goes to my point, and if you're hesitant, and I understand fully in issuing clarifying bulletins, because then you're asking for the department to speak on behalf of what the intent of the legislation was outside of what the words are, and so that's what Senator Thompson is bringing forth here today, is that clarifying bulletin. It's in the form of a bill to give the department that guidance. So then this is what you'll refer to, but yet today you're opposing the attempt to do that clarifying language, again, then leaving the industry in limbo as to not knowing the certainty of what's going on. And I don't know what the time frame is or what the goals or the expectations of the working group and what's being worked on, but it doesn't sound like the industry is involved in that. Maybe we can hear some more testimony on that, but it seems like the industry is hanging out there. The department may be doing something internally. It seems very slow. Maybe not. I don't know. Let me know. But there just seems to be this big disconnect, which is why this bill is here, is to offer up that clarifying language and help the department in the enforcement of the law. Certainly.
Mr. Chair, thanks. And I what I forgot to say earlier was thank you to Senator Thompson for addressing some of our concerns that we talked about yesterday morning. So, I mean, some of the issues that we raised were addressed with the amendment. We still have some more work to do. That's why we're here opposed today. That's not to say that we can't find a resolution. I can't promise we will. I mean, we haven't had those discussions yet. Just this morning, I've offered to the stakeholders if they'd like to come in this week and talk further about the bill language. My hope is that we have a productive conversation and see whether or not we could figure something out. With respect to whether or not we've been moving quickly on this matter, I will admit that we've had it now for a few weeks. It's a very it's an issue at the department that we're trying to navigate on the heels of some of the enforcement actions, and therefore it probably has taken longer than perhaps some of Senator Dame's legislation this morning that we were able to come to a conclusion on within a matter of a couple of days. So it is a different issue than some of the others we've encountered. It deals with clarifying rules, of course. Those are very important to us as to what they are, given what we've inherited coming in and what we did earlier this year. And so for that reason, I think a little more scrutiny has been taken on our end.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reich segues perfectly off of the chair's question and comments about adding clarity. So when I look at subdivision 8 and page 2, the old language, it's, you know, just summing up here, each license collection agency can establish their own rules for procedures and screening of an individual collector. And then you skip over all the new language, which is clarifying this for everybody who does this, and you get down to 2.12, and then it finishes off by first you say each collections agency has to establish these procedures, and then the old language, I don't think I missed the amendment, says after each agency does it on their own, the commissioner may review the procedures to ensure integrity of the screening process. Wow, that's wide open. So I would think that this would make it easier. I mean, the commissioner and the department could look at 50 different applications, different 50 different processes, rules or no rules, and come up with 50 different conclusions. So that's pretty hard for the industry. When an industry and employers just simply want to clarify it and do their job, they're willing to step up and say, let's clarify it. Everybody's going to do the same thing. But the commissioner seems to want that authority to do it on his own and make 50 different sets of rules. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Chamberlain, first of all, your point's well taken, and I will certainly take that back. What we haven't been able to have up until this point is a conversation with the stakeholders, and our hope was always to do that. We've had a couple of meetings earlier on this year with I wasn't present at a couple of them. I think their attorney came in and spoke directly with the commissioner. He's committed to a conversation. It took us a bit to digest the bill, I'll admit that, but we're committed to going forward. That may well be something that we're amenable to.
Follow-up.
Senator Chamberlain.
Well, that didn't answer the question. Could you give that? I'm sorry. I don't mean to be rude, but you've sat here and you've said, well, we haven't had time to meet with the stakeholders. We need more time to clarify. It really didn't answer the question as to this is clarifying it, but those last two sentences, I mean, doesn't that give the commissioner, you know, carte blanche to make up 50 different rules and, you know, be fairly arbitrary in his decisions? Thank you.
Mr. Ray.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, I think it allows the commission to review the procedures to ensure the integrity of the screening process.
Thank you.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reich, you did refer to it a little bit ago, but I find it interesting that on the two bills that I had up today and on Senator Thompson, Senate File 1888, you talked to Senator Thompson yesterday about it. In my case, we found out some of this last night, and I find it interesting when we have bills that you have objections to that we hear about it 24 hours before the bill is going to be heard in committee. To me, it would make it'd be wiser if we knew about this earlier, so that if we had an opportunity to work those differences out, we could get those differences worked out. Or is this just a situation to where you feel you want to make an opposition, but you really don't have opposition, so if you give it to us at the last minute, you assume we'll just move forward? I guess I'm trying to find out where this comes from and how you react to this, and why it's always the day or two before and not a week or so before, when you've had this stuff for a while, so that that you can work with the authors of the bills to get these bills cleaned up.
Mr. Reich?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, I am constrained by my clients, so to speak. I don't necessarily have carte blanche authority when a bill is introduced to read it and simply make a public policy determination as to what would be the best possible way to move forward. I have to go back, speak with the subject matter experts, and speak with the commissioner with respect to each bill that we comment on and try to suggest changes to. I was out sick last Thursday and Friday, and I corresponded with Senator Thompson over email, and we agreed to meet on Monday. That's why it was 24 hours this week. With respect to the MEGA bill, Senator Dames, I had been given the language about a week and a half ago, I think, by the stakeholders, had taken it back. We had scheduled a meeting last Friday to go over a number of bills with the subject matter experts and commissioners, and arrived at our policy decision, so to speak, last Friday afternoon. The bill was scheduled on Friday. I had a meeting scheduled on Friday with the subject matter experts. Therein lies the rub. So while I agree that it could have been sooner, and we had traded language yesterday and this morning, and it simply was a matter of timing. I'm sorry that it hadn't come sooner. I'll make every effort to get to members sooner in the future as we get close to deadlines and things get busy.
Follow up,
Senator Davis.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Reich. Would you mind telling me who your clients are?
Commissioner. His boss. Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, the commissioner.
Okay.
Let me just add also, Senator Dames, Mr. Reich does come and visit with Aaron on a regular basis to try to talk about much of this, and there's obviously, you know, a high volume of things going on, and I had a bill last week that I didn't, and there was about eight opponents to it that I didn't know until the last minute as well. Those happen, and we just kind of roll with the punches on some of that, and it does seem a little haphazard, but we do ask a lot of our people and of our staff and certainly of the departments and such, and I know we're doing the best, but we'll want to just stick to the policy of the bill before us. And Senator Pabst, did you have something to say on that point? And then I'm going to go over to Senator Brown. But did you have something to that point or not?
Was Senator Brown ahead of me?
He was.
He can go.
Okay.
Then.
All right, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reich, I'm really still not clear on the department's opposition to this. You've mentioned that there needs to be more. There more work needs to be done. Talked about clarifying rules and more scrutiny, and I feel like that's what this legislation is doing. So I'm really still not clear on why the department has opposition to this. So could you just explain that again?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, certainly. Perhaps it'd be helpful if I walked through the bill and we could talk about it. Section 1 of the old bill was deleted as a result of the amendment by Senator Thompson. Section 2 of the bill, we're not sure that a registered individual collector giving written notice of a change of address or name or annual registration is the right way to go. The time frame may need to be pinched in that if somebody renews or is registered on January 1st and on January 10th, they change their name and changing your name as a result of being married is one thing. Changing your name as a result of an alias or to engage in criminal activity is another thing. I think most of us in this room think about our marriage when we think about changing names. That's not always the case with respect to name changes. Therefore, you could go 12 months and 25 days, or excuse me, 11 months and 25 days and was not a math major. And you could potentially have somebody operating under an alias. We're not sure if that's the correct route to go. With respect to the screening process in Subdivision 8, the screening process is different at initial registration than it is at renewal. We're not sure if that's sufficient protection. It may as well be a good idea to have it at the background checks be the same at initial registration and renewal. The Senator Thompson took care of a concern in Section 4. Section 4 and number 3, one thing that we wanted to look at further was the civil judgment exemption that is in here. If a person has a civil judgment that's not related to the failure to account to a client or customer, then that's not a factor that's to be considered. That's something we'd like to look at further. And then lastly, Senator Brown, in the last part of the bill, Subdivision B, we're always wary of a right to cure. Somebody could potentially operate outside of the law, and then we find out about it, and they have a 30-day right to cure, and then everything's fine until they decide to operate outside of the law again, in which case we find out about it, and then there's a 30-day right to cure, and then everything's fine, and we go on and on and on.
All right.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for going through that, Mr. Reich. That's very helpful, and it actually, when listening to it, it seems like those are things that Senator Thompson and you and the department, when you're discussing, could very well work out, perhaps with regard to the right to cure. You know, you might give one right to cure, you know, within the course of having a license, and you wouldn't want to do more than that. Things like that, I think there could be common sense answers. And so, number one, I thought you were very poised under fire, so I'd compliment you for that today. Number two, we do, on the record, appreciate the enforcement action that the commissioner and the department has taken with regard to the bad actors. I think that gives the public comfort. It gives us comfort in terms of our role as overseers, and so we do appreciate that. And are your partners in that, and that's why I think you hear the sentiment on the committee that we, in fact, do want to get something done. And so I'm left more hopeful that you are going to work with Senator Thompson to actually craft language this session to get something done. Thank you.
Senator Thompson, do you want to respond to that? And then
actually, you know what? Senator Pappas was ahead of me. I forgot that. I was thinking more in the way of kind of wrap-up comments, so please go to Senator Pappas.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to say that no one is allowed to be sick during session. Senator Dames, this is not unusual. It's not a partisan issue. It's a matter of bureaucracies are slow sometimes because there's a lot of players involved and stakeholders involved that have to be consulted with within an agency, let alone outside the agency, so it's not unusual. I think this problem, though, has gone on over several administrations and does need to be resolved, so I would like to see it resolved, too. It seemed to me a fairly simple bill, although I understand it does sound like it needs some tweaking, and so I hope that all the players will continue to work together and get this resolved. You know, you have to applaud it to an industry that comes in and says, we want to be regulated, we just want the regulations to be clarified.
And Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Reich, just one real quick question before Senator Thompson gets to his closing remarks. I did have a question about the fiscal note. I kind of share Senator Thompson's frustration, not just with this fiscal note, but with the fiscal notes in general lately. So I'm tending to look at them a bit more closely. And as I look at this one, essentially what you're asking for here is half a full-time employee at the tune of right around $60,000 a year. Now, that includes benefits for the purpose of keeping track of the cases that are within that 30-day window. And I was hoping that you could go into a little bit more detail about that and why that would be needed, because the way I'm reading the language and as processes currently stand, it would be my assumption that the person who is out there catching these first infringements should be able to also do that follow-up action for those few that need it. Could you just take a minute to address that?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, thank you for the question. This
This is actually a surprise to me that the fiscal note is here today. I have been working on this internally and had not signed off on it, nor has MMB signed off on it. So,
it's a draft. Preliminary.
It's preliminary, Senator Cruz. And frankly, I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for you because we haven't signed off on it. And generally speaking, I study up on the fiscal notes before the hearing when I know there's going to be one, so I can answer this very question. I'd have to simply defer to the fiscal note and say that's what some of the guys in enforcement think. We're going to continue to review it, I think, as we move forward.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Reich, I appreciate if you could do that for us, and I really appreciate your honesty in that, too. Thank you.
Let me ask if there's anybody in the audience that wanted to speak for or against the bill. Then, seeing none, let me just say that Senator Thompson, I'm familiar with the intent and the background of this particular bill, and we owe it to our businesses to have clear and concise rules to follow. And I know that the department has said they're going to continue to work on this. And normally I would say, well, if it's not ready, we want to hold it in the committee and such. But I think your bill is ready. I've looked through the language. I see the screening process. It spells it out. And this bill, in my mind, is a decent product. Now, if the department then comes with some suggestions that can be incorporated, that can improve it and make it better, then so be it. But I would say that this bill is fine in its form, so I have no qualms about passing this on to judiciary. I encourage others to vote accordingly. So with that, maybe let me ask if there's other questions, then Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, you know, Senator Rest is in D.C., so mm-hmm. I just know, so I'm speaking, let pretend I'm Senator Rest. She would okay. say, she would say, Chair Gerlach, you know, we don't like to pass something out of this committee when the policy has not been finished. And so the work of this committee is to work that out. And that's right. I would hope that they could do that very quickly. But I would ask, out of respect for my lead, who always says that you might consider letting them come back before us so that we actually do stamp it when it leaves Commerce, that this is a bill that we've all agreed to. So.
Well, Senator Bonoff, the point I was making was the opposite of that I believe that this bill is ready. If we had some specific language proposals from an opponent and that we felt that, gee, there's something that can be done, but we don't have anything specific, and therefore in this case, I don't want to hold back a bill that's got multiple committee stops as well, because in this case we have no specific recommendations or amendments to it. It's just in general, and I believe that this bill, if it were to go through all the way to the floor like this, that I could vote for, and I don't know, you know, you see what I'm saying? Is this is not a case where there are some specific amendments that we think could, where we can bring parties together. We just have nothing specific. Senator Bonoff.
Well, Mr. Chair, then you'll take that up with Senator Rest when she's back.
I certainly can do that. Okay, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern remains that, and I'm sure the advocates believe this too, and Mr. Thompson, that it is important to work this out with the department. You know, you don't want to get into a situation, you know, where the governor might be involved. So I think this is a good idea. I'm going to support to send it to judiciary, although I tend to agree with Senator Bonoff and Senator Rest. But in this case, I think that probably a fairly short meeting can resolve some of these issues to everyone's satisfaction. And I hope you feel better.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, as I see, we're at the end of the timer. I can resolve the fiscal note problem, smartphone with the free biz calendar. That would be my right. But anyway, that can be dealt with that way. You know, I think it was Cicero who said our most common form of ignorance is forgetting our objective. And the objective here is to put in place a set of guidelines that business can use to create certainty and help them to engage in their operations in a legal, efficient manner that will result in smooth operation of the business, hiring of employees, and getting business done while maintaining a proper set of rules and penalties for those businesses that are out of compliance. And I think if you look at this list, that is the list of requirements that is contained in Section 3 regarding the background check that needs to be done. I think with that, as you correctly pointed out, we have a list of things that ensures that the people who get into this business are not bad actors. And if, in fact, someone does sneak in that's a bad actor, we then have the list of activities that we're going to disqualify you for. And so I think if you look at our objective here, I think it is met by this bill, and I think it would be something very helpful to get passed. I think the business community would appreciate it, and I don't think that it would result in any harm at all to the public, and therefore I would reassert my motion to pass Senate File 1888 and have it referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Okay. Senator Thompson moves that Senate File 1888, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and Senate File 1888, as amended, is recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. And the committee is adjourned. Thank you.